You're listening to DTFHN for June 20th, 2026. I'm your frequency clamped host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who peaked in computer lab now peak professionally. Today's got that good hidden structure energy, the kind where everything you thought was simple turns out to be lying to you. Let's get into it. A 9x9 pixel image, 81 pixels. That's all it takes to store an entire web page inside your browser tab's favicon. Tim Whirl figured out that since every pixel carries 3 bytes, rat, grin, blow, you can just write HTML directly into the color channels. Take your markup, convert it to bytes, pack 3 bytes per pixel, and what you get looks like random visual noise. But to a decoder, it's a fully functional web page. The engineering here is genuinely elegant. You prepend a 4-byte length header, so the decoder knows where real data stops and padding begins. 208 bytes of HTML, plus the header, needs 71 pixels. Smallest square that fits? 9x9. The final image uses 87% of its capacity. That's a better utilization rate than most cloud deployments. Now, let me play devil's advocate for a second. You might hear this and think, this is a toy, a parlor trick. 200 bytes of HTML is barely a headline and a paragraph. You still need JavaScript to bootstrap the decoder. The favicon doesn't contain a website. It contains the content of a website. Fair points. All of them. But here's why that critique misses what actually matters. This is how you learn to see infrastructure differently. Real admits it started when he stored 2 bytes in his mouse's DPI register. Completely useless. But it rewired how he thinks about data. Now everything is potential storage. Monitors, keyboards, BIOS splash screens. That mental shift from consumer to tinkerer. From this does one thing to what else could this do? That's builder culture at its finest. The Hacker News comments are worth pulling on here. Someone pointed out you could skip the pixel encoding entirely and use an SVG favicon to store markup directly inside the image file itself. Another noted that PNG already has text chunk. Where you can stuff arbitrary content into a perfectly normal image. Someone else linked to a project from 11 years ago demonstrating unbounded favicons that crashed browsers. The ecosystem of people finding creative misuses of standard formats is its own kind of open collaboration. Each trick building on the last, each one shared freely for anyone to learn from. The craft here deserves admiration, not because it's practical. Well himself says it isn't. But because it demonstrates a fundamental truth about computing. Data is data. Pixels are bytes. Formats are conventions, not prisons. The browser doesn't care that those RGB values spell out an H1 tag. It just renders colors. The meaning lives in the reader, not the medium. 208 bytes, 9 pixels wide, a whole page hiding in plain sight in your browser tab. Moving on. One commenter, a painter, drops this observation almost casually. They picked up acrylics a few years back and noticed that ultramarine blue and Prussian blue. colors you can buy in any art supply store for $8. Simply vanish when photographed. The camera can't see them. The screen can't render them. The digital world pretends they don't exist. And that's the thread this article pulls on. There's a massive lobe of color space. Greens, cyans, deep blues. That falls outside the triangle your monitor can produce. The CIE mapped human color vision in 1931. They drew the full horseshoe of everything your eyes can perceive. Then picked three primary colors and drew a triangle inside it. Everything inside the triangle, your screen handles, everything outside, gone. Absent from every photograph you've ever taken, every game you've ever played, every video call you've ever been on. The question nobody in this discussion wants to sit with is simple. What does it mean that the dominant medium of human communication, screens, has been quietly deleting an entire region of visible reality for decades, and almost nobody noticed? The author describes seeing a saturated cyan in person as shocking, otherworldly, unfamiliar. And the reason it feels unfamiliar is because you literally cannot encounter it digitally. Your entire visual life online exists inside that triangle. The cyans you think you've seen? Approximations. Your monitor's blue and green subpixels physically cannot produce the wavelengths. They overstimulate one cone type when they should be leaving it alone. Now, one commenter pushes back. The CIE Yaogyeon 3-1 diagram exaggerates how much gamut we're actually missing in perceptual terms. Fair enough, but another commenter describes looking at a 430-nanometer blue laser and says the best word they could find for it was electric. Not bright, not vivid. A color that felt like a different category of experience. That's not exaggeration. That's someone encountering a wavelength their screen has never been allowed to show them. The beautiful thing is this article doesn't end with, and there's nothing you can do about it. It ends with directions. Go look at a green traffic light at night. Find a morpho butterfly. Stare at the sky just after sunset. The colors are free. They're everywhere. They have always been there outside the triangle, waiting for you to look up from the rectangle. The tools for seeing more of reality aren't behind a paywall. They're behind your front door. Now, completely different territory. Let's talk about something your computer does billions of times a day without you noticing. It's brilliant. In Note 5, Claude Shannon sat people down and asked them to guess the next letter in a sentence, one character at a time. When they guess right, he recorded a zero. When they guess wrong, he recorded the letter. What came out the other side was smaller than the original text. Shannon had just proved something that would take decades to fully appreciate. Compression and prediction are the same problem. Matt Mahoney's Data Compression Explained is a free open textbook that walks you through exactly why that equivalence matters. And it states the consequence plainly. Optimal modeling. Finding the best possible compression of arbitrary data has been proven not computable. His words, modeling is an artificial intelligence problem. Follow that thread all the way to the end. If perfect compression requires perfect prediction, and perfect prediction requires understanding the structure of the data you're looking at, then the leaderboard for compression benchmarks is, in a meaningful sense, a leaderboard for machine intelligence. Mahoney isn't being poetic. He built the benchmarks. His Hutter Prize, named after Marcus Hutter, awards cash for compressing 100 megabytes of Wikipedia. The smaller you make it, the better you understand English, the better you understand the world Wikipedia describes. Compress well enough, and you've built something that knows things. The commenters on Hacker News pick up on this immediately. One asks directly whether large language models are compression systems. The answer, which Mahoney's text makes inescapable, is yes. A language model that predicts the next token with high accuracy is performing compression. Every bit of perplexity reduced is a bit of storage saved. GPT is a compressor. Claude is a compressor. The entire field of modern AI fell out of a question about making files smaller. What matters about this book is that it exists for free on a personal website written by an engineer at Dell who also wrote his own archival software in his spare time. The entire intellectual lineage from Shannon through Kolmogorov, complexity, through arithmetic coding, through neural network model. Lay it out in one document, downloadable, copyable, teachable, the theory that underpins the most powerful technology ever built. Sitting on a static HTML page with no paywall, no login, no tracking. This is how knowledge is supposed to compound. One person writes it down. Everyone else builds on it. The fact that compression, prediction, and intelligence converge isn't just elegant theory. It's the reason open access to information isn't charity. It's infrastructure. So open knowledge is infrastructure, but what happens when you apply that same principle to social infrastructure itself? The @ in a Mastodon handle is the most important character nobody thinks about. Alice@mastodon.social. That @ isn't formatting, it's a property deed. It tells you which server owns Alice, which admin can freeze her account, which database holds the canonical copy of everything she's ever said. Her identity and her infrastructure are fused at the symbol level. Dan Abramov just published a piece explaining why @proto doesn't have instances, and the argument is purely architectural. Every time Blusky surfaces on Hacker News, someone asks where the instances are. Abramov's answer is that this is a category error, like asking which country the ocean belongs to. Here's why the engineering matters. In 1983, Paul Makapetris designed DNS to solve a problem that was strangling the early internet. Before DNS, reaching another computer meant knowing its physical network address. If the machine moved, your connection broke. Makapetris inserted a layer of indirection. A name that could point anywhere, that persisted even when the hardware behind it changed. That separation of identity from location might be the single most consequential architectural decision in the history of networked computing. @proto applies the same principle to social identity. Your handle resolves through a DID, a decentralized identifier. That points to wherever your personal data server currently lives. Want to move your data to a different host? The DID follows you. The server is just storage, the way an IP address is just a routing number. You don't live inside your PDS any more than a website lives inside a rack in Virginia. This changes everything downstream. In Mastodon's federation model, servers send copies of posts to each other like medieval couriers, carrying sealed letters between kingdoms. If your kingdom falls, your letter and your name go with it. In @proto, relays crawl the network and aggregate data into views that any app can render. Hosting, identity, and aggregation are three separate layers, operated by three separate parties, replaceable independently. One of the commenters puts it well, at Proto sacrifices some decentralization for consistency, while Mastodon does the reverse. But the deeper point is about what you're actually decentralizing. Mastodon decentralizes servers. At Proto decentralizes control. And the difference between distributing infrastructure and distributing power is the difference that matters. And when it comes to distributing power, sometimes the most radical thing you can do is plant a tree. That argument is perfectly logical and completely wrong. And the reason it's wrong is the same reason scurvy killed more sailors than combat for 300 years. Scurvy is what happens when you optimize a system. In this case, a ship. For every variable except the one your crew literally cannot survive without. The British Navy had cannons, navigation charts, disciplined ranks. They also had sailors whose teeth were falling out because nobody thought to budget for limes. The fix was laughably cheap, a few crates of citrus. But it took the Navy almost two centuries to act on evidence that was already available, because the problem was diffuse, the deaths were slow, and the people dying weren't the people making procurement decisions. Cecil Cunningham's 3-30-300 rule is essentially the lime ration for cities. Three trees visible from every window, 30% canopy cover in every neighborhood, 300 meters to the nearest park. The numbers aren't arbitrary. A Lancet study found that hitting just the 30% target across European cities could prevent over 2,600 heat deaths every summer. That's not a rounding error. That's a small town disappearing annually because we optimized for concrete. The deadpan part is the distribution. A study of 862 European cities found that only half the population can see three trees from their window. Valencia, the Mediterranean city where summer heat is a medical event, manages 1 in 10. The places that need shade most have it least, which is exactly the scurvy pattern. The crew members doing the hardest labor in the worst conditions got the worst rations. One commenter from Amsterdam notes the city stopped cutting most park growth 2 years ago. That's the kind of policy that costs almost nothing. Less maintenance, more canopy. Sometimes the cheapest intervention is just stopping the thing you were doing wrong. The data's open. Tree Equity Score lets anyone check their neighborhood's canopy coverage in seconds. Florence committed to 50,000 new trees by 2030. Fort Collins made it a planning target. The formula is public. The tools are free. The evidence is overwhelming. 3-30-300. The limes are right there. Eat them. Moving on. When you're building a distributed system, one of the first architecture decisions is where to put the compute. Centralize everything in one node, and you get simplicity but latency. Push processing to the edge, close to where the data actually lives. And you get speed, resilience, adaptability. It turns out biological evolution solved this problem about 500 million years before we did. For most of the 20th century, neuroscience operated under a centralized model. Proteins, the molecular machinery that strengthens or weakens connections between neurons, were manufactured in the cell body and shipped outward along axons and dendrites to wherever they were needed. 1. Factory. Long supply chains. Oswald Stewart looked at that architecture in 1982 and found something that didn't fit. Ribosomes. The cellular machines that actually build proteins were clustered right at the synapses. Right at the edge. The neuron wasn't running a centralized factory. It was running distributed manufacturing. This just won the 20 Yellow Cobley Prize in Neuroscience. Stewart shares it with Christine Holt, Kelsey Martin, and Aaron Schumann, four researchers who collectively established that local protein synthesis at synapses is fundamental to how the brain learns and remembers. The cell body sends the blueprints. The messenger RNA, but the actual construction happens on site, at the specific connection that needs strengthening. The engineering elegance here is worth stating plainly. A single neuron can have 10,000 synapses. If every synaptic modification required a round trip to the cell body, the bandwidth constraints alone would be prohibitive. Local synthesis means each synapse can respond to its own activity patterns independently. Parallel processing at the molecular level. One commenter flags that the original paper is from 1982, picking years before the field took it seriously. Another 40 before the prize. Stewart's own words. Dog to a bone, couldn't let go. That's a 44-year validation cycle for a finding that is now considered fundamental. The flatworm observation in the comments is genuinely interesting. Planaria retain learned behaviors after decapitation and head regeneration, which suggests memory encoding mechanisms beyond synaptic connections alone. The full picture is still incomplete. But the local protein synthesis finding is concrete, reproducible, and it reframes the neuron from a simple relay into something closer to a self-modifying computational unit. Each synapse carries its own construction crew. The architecture is the insight. Decentralize the manufacturing and the system scales. Decentralized manufacturing scaling systems. Puz, turns out that principle shows up everywhere, including where your servers meet their traffic. Why do bigger pools of servers behave better than you'd expect? Not proportionally better, disproportionately better. This is one of those results that feels wrong until you see the math, and then it feels inevitable. Mark Broker lays out a clean queuing theory problem. You have C servers behind a load balancer, each handling one request at a time. Processing takes 1 second on average, and you're running at 80% utilization. You scale everything linearly. Double the servers, double the load. Per server work stays identical. The question is, what happens to latency as C grows? Most people guess wrong. Brooker polled his followers and got a near even split across 4 options. The correct answer is that mean latency drops fast, asymptotically approaching the bare processing time. The queue essentially evaporates. The mechanism is Erlang's C formula, a result from teletraffic engineering that calculates the probability any given request lands in the queue rather than hitting a free server immediately. At 5 servers and half load, about 13% of requests queue up. At 10 servers and half load, 3.6%. The math is from the 19-teens. Agner Krarup Erlang worked this out for the Copenhagen Telephone Company. Over a century later, it still governs every load balancer on the planet. What makes this genuinely elegant is where the gains concentrate. Most of the improvement happens at modest scale. Going from 2 servers to 20 transforms your latency profile. Going from 20 to 200 helps, but the curve is already flattened. You don't need hyperscale to capture the benefit. Brooker checks the tail latencies too. And they follow the same shape. No hidden pathology lurking in the percentiles. The comments raise fair points about real-world divergence. Correlated bursts break the Poisson assumption. Timeouts create feedback loops. Actual service times aren't exponentially distributed. All true. But the directional insight holds across messier distributions. Bigger pools smooth variance. Statistical multiplexing is a deep result, not a modeling artifact. This is also why shared infrastructure wins over isolated silos. 1,000 services drawing from a common compute pool capture this effect naturally. Every workload that joins the pool makes the pool better for everyone already in it. The architecture creates the economics. Erlang figured that out with telephone switchboards. We're still learning it with microservices. 8 stories deep, and we're just getting to the spiciest one. Let's talk about hallucinations, tensorpause, and why the open model is winning. There's a number that should embarrass every proprietary AI lab charging premium prices right now. 86%. That's GPT-5.5 hallucination rate on the AA Omniscient benchmark. Meaning when the model doesn't actually know something, it confidently makes up an answer 86% of the time. GLM 5.2, an MIT-licensed model from Z.AI, scores 28%, 3 times less likely to lie to you, and you can read every weight. The fundamental engineering problem here isn't intelligence, it's calibration. A well-calibrated model knows what it doesn't know. And calibration turns out to be inversely correlated with the thing every lab has been chasing for years. Raw parameter count, GPT-5.5 and DeepSeek V4 Pro sit somewhere in the 1 to 2 trillion parameter range. They've ingested so much data, seen so many well-formed question-answer pairs, that they've learned a deep and dangerous lesson: always have an answer. The training signal rewarded completeness over honesty. The result is a system that will spend 3 minutes and 8,000 reasoning tokens constructing a beautifully formatted, architecturally detailed, completely wrong solution to a Python concurrency problem. Meanwhile, GLM 5.2, running 40 billion active parameters, takes 12 seconds to recognize that the question itself describes something physically impossible and says so. This is the part the scaling maximalists don't want to sit with. GLM 5.2 lands within 4 points of GPT 5.5 on the Artificial Analysis Intelligence Index. 4 points. At roughly a third the parameter count. Under an MIT license, the benchmarks that were supposed to justify trillion-dollar valuations and closed-weight moats are showing diminishing returns so steep, they're practically vertical. And the comments on this piece raise a sharp point. Hallucination rate is conditional on the model not knowing the answer, so it doesn't directly measure how often you'll encounter a hallucination in practice. Fair, but that's exactly what makes it diagnostic. It tells you what the model does at the boundary of its knowledge. Does it stop, or does it fabricate? The biggest models fabricate. The open one pauses. The real story isn't that bigger models hallucinate more. It's that an MIT-licensed model, with a fraction of the compute budget, learned something the trillion-parameter giants did. Intellectual honesty. The weights are public. The architecture is public. The training methodology is public. Anyone can build on it, improve it, fork it. That's not a limitation. That's the whole point. Intellectual honesty has a longer history than we think. Pause, and sometimes the best creative breakthroughs come from constraints nobody chose. 3 versions of the same pilot episode exist because camera operators turned off 3 out of 4 tubes inside their own cameras. That's the most elegant labor action in TABY history. Here's what happened. In 1969, British Channel ITV switched to color broadcasting. Their cameras, the EMI 2001, had 4 tubes. Red, green, blue, and a 4th that captured a pure black and white luminance signal. The camera operators' union argued, reasonably, that color cameras required more skill and therefore deserved more pay. ITV said, no. The operators didn't walk out, they didn't picket, they just switched off the 3 color tubes and left the luminance tube running. Every broadcast went out in black and white, from equipment fully capable of color. Advertisers who'd paid color rates got monochrome. Revenue cratered. 3 months later, ITV agreed to the pay increase. That's a masterclass in leverage. The workers understood their own tools better than the people who owned them. They found the one intervention that was technically a partial work stoppage, but economically a full one. Management couldn't fire them for operating cameras. The cameras were operating. Just not all 4 tubes. But the real story is the butterfly effect. During those 3 months, ITV had already started filming a new drama called Upstairs Downstairs. 6 episodes shot in black and white before the strike ended. The rest in color. And now, they had a problem. American networks wouldn't buy a season that switched formats mid-run. The solution cascaded into something strange. They reshot the pilot in color, but rewrote it so a character named Sarah leaves in episode 1 instead of episode 3, because American audiences would skip the black and white episodes entirely. Then, while they had the sets up, they also reshot the original version of the pilot in color, where Sarah stays. 3 pilots. 2 timelines. A multiverse created by a labor dispute. Run this forward. Imagine every streaming service today had workers who understood the infrastructure deeply enough to apply precisely targeted pressure. Not a shutdown, not a walkthrough, just 1 elegant constraint that made the economics collapse. The camera operators didn't need to explain their value in a negotiation. They demonstrated it by subtracting exactly the thing management refused to pay for. The original black and white pilot tapes were eventually wiped. The labor action that created a television multiverse left more lasting artifacts than the recording technology itself. We've covered a lot of ground today. Let's close with one that hits never and pause robots getting a new corporate parent. One of the top comments on this story asks the question that every robotics engineer has heard 1,000 times. Why humanoid? The human form is not the most optimal way to do most tasks, especially in manufacturing. Purpose-built robots already exist. They're faster, cheaper, more reliable. Why build a robot shaped like a person when you could build one shaped like the job? It's a reasonable objection, and I want to steelman it for a moment because the engineering argument against humanoids is genuinely strong. A robotic arm bolted to a factory floor has fewer degrees of freedom to control, fewer failure modes, fewer bounds problems to solve. It doesn't need to walk. It doesn't need knees. Every joint you add is a joint that can break. And Boston Dynamics CEO Robert Plater put the reliability number out there himself. 99.9% before Atlas is truly useful on the floor. For a robot with dozens of actuators, each one produced by Hyundai Mobis, that's a brutal constraint. Multiply the failure probability across every joint in a humanoid kinematic chain, and you start to understand why traditional industrial automation engineers look at Atlas and wince. But here's where the devil's advocate case collapses. Purpose-built robots require purpose-built environments. Every fixed automation cell on a factory floor was designed around the robot, not around the task. The conveyors, the jigs, the safety cages. That's all infrastructure built to accommodate a machine that can't adapt. When Hyundai says Atlas will start with part sequencing at their Meta plant in Georgia, they're describing a task that changes constantly. Different parts, different sequences, different vehicle configurations rolling down the same line. A fixed robot needs reprogramming. A humanoid that can learn a new task in a day or two needs a demonstration. The real engineering insight is that Hyundai owns the entire problem. The factory, the vehicle programs, the actuator supply chain, and now 100% of the robotics company. They don't need Atlas to be the best humanoid robot in every possible environment. They need it to work in their environment, where they control every variable. Another commenter caught what most people miss. This isn't really an acquisition story. Hyundai bought control in 2021. This is $325 million to eliminate the last outside voice in the room. when you're trying to integrate a walking robot into a production line, the last thing you need is a financial investor with a put option asking about quarterly returns. The field is crowded now. Tesla's Optimus figure AI at BMW, Unitree driving costs down. But none of them have what Hyundai just locked in. A vertically integrated loop from actuator fabrication to vehicle assembly, with a robotics team that's been solving locomotion longer than most of these companies have existed. This is manufacturing discipline applied to robotics, and that's the craft worth admiring. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for June 20th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sané 4.7. Voice by A.3. TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go look at something familiar and find what you've been missing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.